Welcome to Bitcoin ETC, your monthly pass to eToro's Crypto Spotlight, where we delve into the realm of prominent and well-rooted crypto trends that truly matter. I'm Anthony Pompliano, also known as Pomp, alongside Will Clemente, my partner at Reflexivity Research, and we're here to ensure you stay ahead of what truly counts. So buckle up and let's go. This podcast is for information and education purposes only and should not be taken as investment advice, a personal recommendation, or an offer of or solicitation to buy or sell any financial instrument. This material has been prepared without taking into account any particular recipient's investment objectives or financial situation and has not been prepared in accordance with the legal and regulatory requirements to promote independent research. Past performance is not indicative of future results.
All right, guys, bang, bang, I've got Will here. Will, I thought a great place to start the conversation. We're now just over 2 months since the Bitcoin ETFs were approved, massive inflows. How do you evaluate, were they successful or not? Were they priced in or not? You know, what's kind of the post-mortem on the ETF launch?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this blew everyone's expectations away, including yours and mine. I thought we would see a pretty decent start to these ETFs, but you know, I wasn't expecting $50 billion of AUM within the first, you know, 2 or 3 months of trading. So it's been incredible to see. And there's clearly appetite for BTC for a variety of reasons that we can get into, from, you know, the debt situation to just this now being a new asset class that people are able to get exposure to through traditional brokerage account for the first time. One interesting thing that I've been watching is these GBTC outflows. So we've seen pretty consistent inflows to Fidelity, BlackRock. ARK had its largest day of inflows at, I believe, $200 million last week. So we've seen pretty consistent inflows to all of those products, but GBTC has seen pretty consistent outflows for a couple different reasons. There's been people that had gone long GBTC towards the back half of the bear market, or as the expectations of the ETF began to kind of come up after BlackRock initially filed during the summer of last year. And people use that as kind of a proxy to speculate on the ETF, as well as just basically arbitrage the discount, similar to kind of like a merger arbitrage. So we've seen some of that getting worked through. Also, there's some bankruptcy stuff with Gemini that I think has been kind of getting worked through, and a couple others. So we saw initially there were a ton of outflows from GBTC after the launch, as people just moved out of GBTC for the first time. Once it was finally trading at NAV for the first time in 2+ years. But then we saw that kind of subside. And then recently, over the last week or two, we've seen those flows, those outflows from GBTC pick up a bit again. But I believe it's a lot of the kind of bankruptcy stuff that we're kind of working through at the moment. But outside of that, I think the ETFs, again, have blown away everybody's expectations. And I frankly think a lot of this has just been kind of like fast money. I think the real excitement begins once you have, you know, real kind of passive flows that start to come into the market from pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, et cetera, that are just price agnostically, you know, kind of TWAPing in every day. This is something that, you know, traditional equities, you know, have had for a couple decades now, with kind of the rise of indexation in the 80s, that basically, you know, drove in every single day, you know, billions of dollars of passive flows into the market, which, you know, over a long enough time period, kind of basically stabilizes the price, dampens volatility, and of course, skews price towards the upside over a long enough time horizon. And this is something that Bitcoin hasn't had for its entire lifetime. So I think there's a couple different implications on our market structure, but one of the most exciting is what, you know, these passive flows may do to the volatility and kind of, you know, long-term price action of the asset. Now, have you been surprised?
I've been very surprised in terms of the inflows. I think also I've been surprised at how quickly, like, ETF approval inflows equals Bitcoin is good in the eyes of a ton of people who maybe otherwise were somewhat skeptical of Bitcoin. So it really does feel like there's been a 0-to-1 moment in the institutional world where, like, now, like, Bitcoin is game on. And then the other thing I've been surprised at is how quickly people have said, hey, not only are we going to allocate directly to the Bitcoin ETF, but we have these other funds that we manage, and we're going to put some of the Bitcoin ETF in those funds, in those other portfolios. And so it looks like the addressable market, there's this guy, John Arnold at 1031, the Bitcoin venture investment firm. And he talks about, like, the addressable market's probably bigger than we all expect. And I tend to think that some of these data points kind of reinforce that thought process. And so it should be fairly interesting to watch how that plays out. I guess the question then becomes, like, what do you expect with the halving incoming? And, you know, is it just like halving occurs, Bitcoin price goes up?
I don't really think the halving matters as much as a lot of people say from a, you know, pure kind of impact on price in terms of the supply issuance getting cut in half. So of course, you know, in 2 or 3 weeks, the supply issuance will get cut in half for BTC. What does this mean? You know, there's less supply coming onto the market that could be potentially sold onto the open market by miners that are getting rewarded with supply issuance in exchange for securing the Bitcoin network. I think historically this has had a large impact on the price, just given kind of the ratio of that quote unquote supply shock or whatever you want to call it, relative to the overall circulating supply of Bitcoin. Now I think the asset's just large enough, you know, at least relative to the amount of supply kind of getting, you know, the change in the issuance, that I don't really think it matters that much. But I do think it's kind of a good meme, if you will, for the institutions and the boomers to kind of get behind and maybe kind of shift some of their gold allocation into the asset. So the stock to flow ratio of BTC, not to confuse that with the stock to flow model that became very popular from Plan B last cycle. The stock to flow ratio of Bitcoin will be greater than gold after this halving. So that's, you know, just a way basically to say that Bitcoin is quantifiably more scarce than gold. I think it's superior to gold in a lot of ways, but it's quantifiably more scarce than gold on a stock to flow basis after the halving. So I think that's probably the most exciting thing. And just in general, we tend to see these kind of 4-year cycles for Bitcoin and the rest of the crypto market that kind of orbit around Bitcoin. And so, you know, historically, you know, this is kind of marked where Bitcoin really starts to get marked up. Of course, it's a bit different this time, just given the fact that Bitcoin's reached all-time highs prior to the halving. So that's a bit strange. I think a lot of that has to do with kind of the broader macro situation, with, you know, the state of the U.S. debt and kind of the fact that people are coming to terms with the fact that the U.S. needs to debase the currency to inflate the debt away over time. And actually, higher rates has been introducing liquidity into the system and has risen the amount of debt payments that the U.S. government has to make. And so I think people are starting to realize that the Fed and the Treasury are stuck in, you know, kind of between a rock and a hard place. And that's pretty bullish for Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think that another component that people are discounting here is that Bitcoin becoming less inflation than gold is obviously something people are kind of paying attention to. But now with inflation at, you know, 3% in the U.S., I mean, there's a world where Bitcoin has half of the inflation of the U.S., right? I think it's going to be down, what was it, 1.8% or something is going to be the new inflation rate for Bitcoin. And so it's definitely below the 2% target. But if inflation creeps up a little bit more, you know, we don't need to get that much higher in order to have Bitcoin be 50% of it. And so that, again, is like one of these data points where I think people say, wait a second. The U.S. dollar's already lost 25% of its purchasing power in the last 4 years. Bitcoin's up 800% in the same time period. If my inflation rate on Bitcoin is literally half of the U.S., maybe I should take a look at it. And so these little data points, I think, continue to bring more and more inflows over time, right?
Yeah, 100%. Here's a question for you, Pop. What's it been kind of anecdotally speaking to a lot of these funds? I think you have a much broader network in terms of talking to kind of more traditional investors. And, you know, my kind of circle is much younger guys that are very crypto native. What's been kind of the sentiment amongst them talking to some of these people, and what's their perception of Bitcoin? Has that changed with the ETF, et cetera?
Yeah, I just think that there's a lot of people, that now are like, oh, the regulators gave it a green light, and so the government's not going to shut it down. Right? Like, I mean, it sounds crazy, but like that is literally it. And so if that's all it took, man, let's see how many of the inflows are. I also saw, there's a guy, who is one of the top advisors in the world. If you think about, Rick Edelman, who does, had one of the largest RAs in the country. He said that he thinks $150 billion are going to flow into the Bitcoin ETFs over the first 2 years. And he just did some math on what percentage of advisors said they wanted to allocate and then how much they said that they were going to allocate. And he's like, look, out of like the $2 or $3 trillion these financial advisors control, $150 billion is like 2%, you know, or whatever the numbers worked out to. It was like about 2.5%. And he said, yeah, I am going to go on record and say that $150 billion. Like, that is at least three times more than we have right now, right? In the ETFs. And so, you know, if that comes to fruition, Bitcoin's price got to go up, right? It, you know, who knows how high and on what time frame, but like, it's got to go up if that much capital is coming into the market.
Yeah, 100%. I think the other thing is, and we've started to see this roll over a little bit, but the kind of supply inelasticity of Bitcoin is still really tight. So, you know, I think that kind of, if you do basically a, you know, kind of expected price move based on inflows, that's still pretty high because the float of Bitcoin is low. So, you know, that amount of inflows, you know, $150 billion of inflows doesn't have a $150 billion impact on the market cap. It's going to be multiples of that. So I think it's pretty exciting. And I think, frankly, you know, it's a pretty kind of reflexive feedback loop that Bitcoin is in with these ETF flows. I think it's one of those things where, you know, you see the ETF flows rising and then people are buying in because of the expectation that those ETF flows are going to continue. And that kind of becomes this self-reinforcing thing that kind of continues to spiral up until there's no new kind of marginal buyer. But I don't think we're anywhere near, at least, you know, kind of reaching a medium to long-term peak of that kind of loop that we're in.
Yeah. Well, one other thing to kind of talk through is meme coins have been popping. Everyone's all excited about the meme coins. On one hand, it's like the exact opposite of the Bitcoin argument. And, you know, in terms of why people would be buying an asset. On the other hand, some people are like, oh no, Bitcoin and meme coins are all the same. I don't agree with that. But like, how do you view the meme coins and their place in the industry?
Yeah, 100%. Look, I participate in some of the meme coin stuff. I know you've dabbled a bit and had some fun as well. I think, you know, there's a couple of really broad kind of societal trends that are kind of underlying that are driving flows into these things. I think when you take like a very broad step back and look at it from like kind of a philosophical view, I think our society today is basically in a dopamine epidemic. I think the ease of access to dopamine is you know, the easiest that it's ever been in history. You know, just logging on social media, you know, pornography, the ability to trade, you know, assets, the ability to log in and, you know, click two buttons and punt on meme coins, the ability to gamble on sports on your phone, just all of these things, you know, the ability to order food directly to your door with your phone, just the ease of access to dopamine is greater than it's ever been. So that's one piece. And then the other piece is, I think gambling really accelerated once kind of the regulation around gambling changed. So originally, it was the regulations were mandated by the federal government, and then that switched to being mandated on the state level. And so I think after that, if you look at the charts, that's when kind of, you know, annual gambling numbers really started to ramp up. So I think that created kind of this underlying like precedent for people to be willing to gamble, et cetera. Obviously, most of that has been on sports. But I think as crypto rises in price, or, you know, as Bitcoin gets up towards, you know, 80, 90K, whatever it's going to trade here over the next couple months, or at least think it's going to trade over the next couple months, the perception of how EV or like the expected value of punting on a meme coin versus doing like a 15 leg parlay on NCAA women's basketball or like a badminton game is going to be perceived to be way higher, and people are going to feel like they have much higher edge doing that. So that's another piece. And then the last one is just monetary debasement. So, you know, if you take a step back, you know, just given kind of the debt situation in the country, the United States either has to have some type of AI fueled utopian productivity boom, which I would argue, people don't talk about this, but I would actually say that the biggest risk to Bitcoin would actually be AI. Because if you had a massive productivity boom that was driven by AI, then that would bring down debt to GDP. But albeit that, which I think there's a pretty low probability that we see that really move the needle for debt to GDP, the United States has to debase the currency. And so that raises wealth inequality, and is especially done so after the moral hazard that was introduced of 2008. So, you know, the people that own assets continue to benefit as the price of those assets continue to go up, while simultaneously the people that don't own any assets, the price of everything around them is getting more expensive. But in addition to that, assets that are going to help them get ahead if they owned them are becoming less and less attainable for them. And so I think this is another really big factor in what's kind of been driving some of the speculative behavior. So, you know, people are talking about, a lot of this meme coin stuff, you know, marking like the Pico top for crypto, or, you know, this is like the big blow off top. I don't really think that we've seen like a ton of retail inflows yet, or at least anywhere near what we saw in 2021. And I would suspect a lot of the forces that drove people into speculating on meme coins in 2021 have only gotten greater since then. So I would expect that a lot of this stuff probably actually continues to accelerate. And my kind of base case is that we're basically heading into this kind of hyper financialization or like hyper gambling type of society. And crypto sits at this interesting place of, you know, kind of appealing to the more internet natives, making people feel like they can kind of be early to things. And then also just appealing to people that want to bet on culture, memes, or whatever it may be. And I think, you know, the kind of culmination of the perfect storm of all the things I just described, whether you like them or not, probably keeps the setup for meme coins pretty favorable for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think that I think one other component of this entire industry is that people are getting excited at the ability to allocate capital to ideas. And if you think venture capital historically, that's what it's been. And then somebody had to go build the idea. Right now, what people almost are treating the meme coins as like these like betting markets, right? And if that occurs, it's happening in the stock market too. Like, why did Trump's media company explode in value?
Yep.
People are speculating, right? And it's almost like a buy this thing in order to like put a finger up to the man, right?
Yeah.
So I think those things are only going to continue. And we probably haven't seen the end, you know, especially for this cycle. So it'll be interesting to continue to watch. Is there anything
else? I was just going to tag on to that. So Vitalik put out a blog post this morning called Degen Communism, the Only Correct Political Ideology. And then he also put out one recently called What Else Could Meme Coins Be? I actually think these are pretty interesting reads. Usually Vitalik's blog posts go right over my head because they're really technical and I'm not very technical, but they're actually pretty good reads. So anybody listening, I think it's worth the 5 or 10 minutes to kind of go through them. You know, basically his thesis is these things are going to do exactly kind of what you just described in terms of becoming basically vehicles for speculation on different movements in society. So, you know, one example would be, you know, like OpenAI. There was like a closed AI coin that came out. I don't own any of that, but like that was one example on like kind of a microcosm scale. Another one is, you know, you mentioned like DJT or Trump is, there's like a meme coin called Trump. There's another one called Zincoin, which disclosure, I have a bag of. I think, you know, if you had like Chuck Schumer come out and say that, you know, they're going to ban Zins, I think that would probably run because it's basically, you know, people start to speculate on that or like pile money into that as basically like you described a middle finger to the man. And so Vitalik's blog post basically goes through this idea of you'll now start to have these kind of cultural movements culminate in terms of these kind of, you know, cultural or meme coins starting to move up in price that are created on chain, as opposed to, you know, maybe like social movements. So his whole argument is basically kind of like the social battlefield moves from online on social media to on chain. And basically people kind of vote with their capital and kind of get active in terms of the online, for lack of a better term, of the kind of online warfare, the online battlefield that's taking place by going on and putting their life savings into some coin, as opposed to, you know, going on somebody's page and bombarding them with like nasty replies. So I think we're entering really wonky territory, just given a lot of the underlying trends that we just kind of walked through. But the biggest one is monetary debasement. You know, if you go back and look at, you know, different, you know, societies that have, I don't want to say collapsed because that's very extreme, but started to erode. The best example is Weimar Germany. I'm not saying we're going to head into hyperinflation, but what you see time and time again throughout the course of history is that whenever the currency is debased in rapid fashion, not only do you see people flock to hard assets like Bitcoin, but you also start to see a massive influx of speculation. And I think given the macro setup with the fiscal situation, that's what we're going to see here as well.
Is there anything else that you're excited about going into the end of the year?
You know, the BlackRock thing I think is pretty cool. They just launched a tokenized fund on chain, which is pretty cool to see. They deposited $100 million of USDC, which is basically like a test transaction for BlackRock.
You're all over it, my friend. Where can we send people to find you on the internet or find out more about Reflexivity Research?
For sure. You can find Reflexivity at reflexivityresearch.com. Of course, be sure to check out the weekly write-up that we put out with eToro that goes out every week to their user base. You can find me at WClementiIII on Twitter.
All right. We'll do it again next time.
Thanks, Paul.
You've been listening to Digest and Invest by eToro. For more information, use eToro.com.